Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Amanda Farrow.
And I'm Michael Footer.
Each episode will cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros. This is episode 74, What Happens When a Developer DMCAs Their Own Game. Okay. You ready?
I am ready.
What are you ready for?
I'm ready for this episode.
Are you ready to clown around?
I don't know what that's from.
It's from The Big Comfy Couch. You're so American.
Yes, I'm so American.
So American. Hey, what's up first today?
Hey, first up, Epic. Eating another studio. Om nom nom nom.
Yeah,
nom.
But Epic doesn't really like nom at studios.
There's been so much like... M&A this quarter already.
We wrote about that in our trends piece, and I wrote about that for GamesBeat. Like, I knew that this was going to be a big year for M&A, but I did not realize how big of a year that this was going to be, because this is enormous.
Indeed. Epic has announced its purchase of Tonic Games Group, a.k.a. Mediatonic, developer of Fall Guys.
I've never heard of Fall Guys.
Yes, you have. Gabe was a red panda.
Yeah.
And then he was Mugman.
Yeah, he's Mugman right now.
And then he was a turret from
No, but he's back to being Portal. Mugman.
Oh, he's back to being Mugman.
Yeah, he's actually out in the living room playing Fall Guys.
So, no terms were disclosed. Mediatonic, as you might recall, is also behind the excellent Murder by Numbers and Hatful Boyfriend, a dating adventure visual
novel.
It's
a dating simulator visual novel.
About pigeons.
Where,
you make sweet, sweet love to coo-coo-coo.
So, I mean, like, it's more complicated than that, but yes. I liked Hatful Boyfriend. It was really good.
Where pigeon sex is involved, it's always more complicated, Amanda.
Okay. All right. Well, okay. So the studio has grown from 35 people to more than 150.
Fall Guys has been such a huge success. It's coming to Switch. It's coming to Xbox. Amazing.
And we knew it was going to... Like, listen, when I previewed it, back in, I think it was like 2018.
It was at E3.
It might have been at 2018 or 2019. I don't remember which one. But I do remember that when I previewed it, I was like, this is something really special.
Indeed.
This is something that is going to take the world by storm, and it's going to be an unstoppable force. And I'm really glad that I was right. It's not often that I'm right about these things, because sometimes games that I love, no one else will like. But I was right about this because it was sticky.
Absolutely. So this gives Epic now a third family-friendly game, the first being Fortnite, of course. Then they acquired Psyonix and Rocket League, and now Fall Guys. So Rocket League, of course, was originally first a PlayStation Plus game when it launched. And then it had a price tag attached to it on all the platforms that it was on.
Absolutely.
And it went free to play. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's some reasonable speculation here that down the road, Fall Guys, maybe after the deal closes. I don't know if it's actually closed yet. They didn't talk about any terms at all.
No, zero terms. So, nothing was disclosed. It'll be interesting to see what they end up doing with Fall Guys. There's a lot of potential in crossover between Fall Guys and Rocket League and Fall Guys and Fortnite. Mm-hmm. Like, it's really interesting to me, this like family of games, this family of family-friendly games, mm-hmm. essentially. That are all very successful in their own rights with honestly some overlapping audience. Like, this is
brilliant.
But
not a huge amount. Like, no. I think they serve very different purposes, and they hit very different age groups. And all of them have wide appeal at the same time.
Exactly.
So, interestingly, a Mediatonic's website, where they announced the acquisition, they answer the question about free-to-play. Nothing to announce at this point. So I think they're already thinking that people are going to be asking that question. I'm sure journalists are asking that question.
Yeah.
As they covered this.
For sure. So also in the press release, Tim Sweeney had this to say, quote, "It's no secret that Epic is invested in building the metaverse, and Tonic Games shares this goal. As Epic works to build this virtual future, we need great creative talent who know how to build powerful games, content, and experiences."
This is really interesting.
This is hitting now on two of our big trends for the year. The metaverse and mergers and acquisition.
So, interesting. I don't think this is a bad thing. I think Epic has been a good custodian for Rocket League so far. I have no reason to be worried about this. I think there's enough evidence now. This is that we're not seeing the same panic we did when Microsoft bought Mojang.
Yes. But if we also look backward at Microsoft's track record, prior to Phil Spencer taking over, they had a tendency to close down studios. And even when Phil took over at Xbox Game Studios, it was a mess. Yes. And he had to clean up an enormous mess that Matrick left him.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
So there was a good reason for a lot of people to be as trepidatious as they were. Thankfully, there has obviously been nothing to worry about. Minecraft has only gotten better and stronger and more appealing, especially with that ray tracing, though.
Absolutely. It's really pretty.
It's really pretty. Speaking of other, like, pretty deals, we got some more M&A to talk about. So Zynga has acquired Ectra Games, the studio led by Diablo and Torchlight co-creator Max Schaefer.
Yeah, Ectra's first game is actually Torchlight 3. Yes. Now, you may recall, they are not the developer of the original two Torchlight games. Runic, which developed the first two Torchlight titles, was closed in 2017.
So Ectra has been around since 2016. Terms were not announced, but Zynga says it was not quite as large as previous M&A deals. And if you go back and you have a listen to what Zynga was talking about during their earnings report with CEO Frank Gibeau, this is well in line with what Zynga is looking to accomplish this year.
The deal supports Zynga's growth into cross-platform play. That's something we talked about when you wrote up for our show, Zynga's earnings, and that we talked about following the Nintendo Direct,
indeed,
which is where they announced Star Wars Hunters, which is going to be on mobile and Switch.
That looks really cool.
Indeed. So here we have this another game here that has the potential, another studio that has the potential to cross that divide and make cross-platform titles on console, on mobile, on PC.
That is what Zynga wants. Zynga wants cross-platform play, and they didn't talk a lot about progression, but they were talking about cross-platform play.
Yes.
So I'll be interested to see what happens with Ectra Games. Again, if we're talking about good stewardship, Zynga has been an excellent steward for each of the studios that they have acquired over the years, including the studio behind Merge Dragons, which has done exceptionally well. What's next, Mike?
Sony Interactive Entertainment is supporting four organizations that work in the Black community. This is a fulfillment of a promise that was made in June 2020 to invest $1 million in organizations focused on social justice, education, and economic empowerment to address racial inequality. The company announced its intent to work with Black Girls Code, The Hidden Genius Project, Gameheads, and Black in Gaming.
I love that. So, a reminder, the purpose is to, quote, work with these partners to evoke long-lasting change by improving access to the tech and gaming industry and building a better structure for Black voices to be heard. Sony has reminded us that this is also just the beginning, as they are calling these groups their, quote, initial partners with an intent to drive long-term change to achieve social justice and race equality.
Yes. So more partners will be announced in the future. I think $1 million is a good start when you look at companies as large as the big publishers in this industry, though.
More.
Yes. And Humble, which is significantly smaller than Sony or EA or Activision, is doing, they started with $5 million and they went to $10 million, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is an excellent start, but it is only,
it's only the beginning.
And it is only one vehicle. Money is important, and I don't want to downplay the importance
of money. Money is extremely important.
But as we'll talk about a little bit later in the show, making sure your communities are safe for people of all backgrounds, from hate, from misogyny, from racism, making sure that your communities are safe is also a big part of doing the work.
Absolutely.
Oh, look, so, it's actually time to talk about
that. I was about to say, I'm like, it actually is time to talk about Twitch. And we're not talking about Twitch from an overly critical perspective, which is what Mike and I have a tendency to do. We are going to be talking about their first transparency report about security and safety. So the report itself included a lot of information about the platform's auto mod, which filters out chat messages before they can even be read.
Yeah.
It also talks about channel creator and mod bans and timeouts.
So those are two aspects. We've got one that is kind of an the automated side of things. We've got one where, hey, here are the tools we provided to creators and moderators to keep their communities safe. But where we're interested is what Twitch is doing on the platform side when things start to get out of hand. When the tools that moderators and channel creators have aren't enough. When AutoMod isn't able to pick it up because it subverts the algorithms, or it is something that AutoMod isn't designed to cover.
Yeah, exactly. So we need to talk about some of the numbers here, because these numbers are Banana Pants. So in 2020, and remember this is talking about the breadth of 2020, mm-hmm. Twitch received 13.3 million reports across categories from small, and this is, we're going to talk about the smallest percentage, so like the tiniest little piece of that mm-hmm. report pie, to the largest. So it started off with terrorism, terrorist propaganda, and recruitment.
Then adult nudity, photography, and sexual content.
Violence, gore, threads, and other shocking content.
Hateful conduct, sexual harassment, and harassment.
And shockingly up top, viewbotting, spam, and other community matters.
So what it sounds like is a lot of the reports that they receive are people trying to game Twitch's system. So inflate their view counts, and which I don't understand the purpose of, because they're not converting. Those aren't things that are convert to subscriptions.
Well, the problem isn't about that. It's about gaming your way to partner. I think Twitch is getting a little bit smarter about that. They are, for sure. But there are a ton of people out there that do use ViewBots to inflate their numbers. It's not sustainable. And it's something that we've talked about on our stream team that Mike mm-hmm. and I are both a part of, the Radically Kind Gamers. So it is kind of shocking that that is like the top percentage of reports.
Yeah.
Not harassment. But viewbotting.
But spam is another one. So what we saw this. You're in the middle of a charity stream right now for Hit Save.
I am.
How many spam bots did you have pop in the first couple of hours? And if you stream, you've seen these things. It's like, oh, I want to increase your views. There's spam bots that are promoting viewbotting.
It's true. And the only way to really to get around that is to ensure that they confirm their email address. Mm-hmm. So you can set that up in your mod settings so that you never see bots. So I personally never see bots because I have very, very locked down moderation. But we're pretty loose and go with the flow over on Hit Save. But yeah. So anyway, coming back to it.
So Twitch, now when we look at, those are the number of reports, 13.3 million.
13.3 million reports.
When we look at how many enforcement actions Twitch took. So that is looking at those reports and then making a ban, a suspension, whatever.
Right.
Right. There was a hair shy of 2 million enforcements. That amounts to 14.9%. So, out of the total number, 13.3 million reports that Twitch receives, which these are reports that are all supposedly reviewed by humans. That's a lot.
That's a lot to that be reviewed by people. And like we honestly do need to give a big shout out to Twitch for even hitting that.
Here's what I want to say about that. I read through the report. I did not see Twitch disclose how many people are on that team and what how many of these reports were viewed by each member of the team on average.
And not just that, but ensuring that these moderators are taken care of with regards to their mental health.
Exactly.
That is not part of the transparency report. And Twitch, quite frankly, if you're listening, that is information that the public deserves to know.
And here's what I'm going to say. If your team is only 5, 7, 10,
that's an enormous amount of reports to get through for such a small amount of people.
30, 40, 50, 70 people.
Heck,
you know,
go into the hundreds.
Exactly. Like I think Twitch, like part of this transparency report that we need to see is how many people you have on your safety and security team that are reviewing reports. And as Amanda said, how you're taking care of them. Because as we've heard about Facebook, we've heard about Twitter, about all of the people, about Reddit, all those people who have to review those comments and be subjected to all of that hate and vitriol, you know, that takes a toll.
It wears on the soul. That's absolutely for sure. So that 14.9%, so 2 million enforcement actions, that's, I know that it seems like such a small amount, and I know that that is what people have been looking at and being like, oh, it's not enough. And it's not. It really isn't, but we also have to look at it within context.
Right, and the other thing that's not clear here is they talk about the number of reports. So if someone says something racist or someone puts out racist content mm-hmm. and is reported by 20 people.
Is that one report?
Is that considered one report, or is it 20 reports versus one action? So I think there are gaps in the data here.
Sure, yeah.
That as I was reading this, first of all, the data is not presented in the cleanest way. Because there's multiple labels on the axes, and it actually really tripped me up, and I finally parsed it. But there are holes in the data here. So if you have a very visible streamer, there was an incident, right, where the guy made a joke and was raiding this woman and had his had his viewers flood into this woman's stream after a raid and scream profanity, like type mm-hmm. profanity over and over and over again. If 100 of us, if 200 of us, if 300 of us reported that streamer for that behavior, and they took the one action, which is to ban this person, you know, it's skewing their numbers in a way. Like, yeah. I would like to see them find a way to group that data.
Sure.
So, how many of your actions, you know, covered X number of reports?
Sure.
And because I think, it might not be 15% is what I'm saying. Sure. It might be significantly higher than that.
It could very well be. We don't have that information to mm-hmm. make that call, and we can't even really do anything more than speculate. Right.
This is me just requesting better data.
Yes. Yes. Requesting better data. So, something else to keep in mind. In the second half of the year, Twitch took 3 times the number of enforcement actions for hateful conduct, harassment, and sexual harassment.
Twitch says that that's based on improved processes and increased capacity to review reports. Now, one of the things they did do is they did adjust for the increase in volume between the first half of the year and the second half of the year as the pandemic went on.
Yeah, absolutely.
They did not see a major uptick in reports or overall enforcement. It's just that the part of the numbers looking skewed mm-hmm. is because of increased volume.
Sure. And I think the other portion of this is that Twitch didn't start cracking down on hateful conduct, especially because the terms of service on Twitch these days now includes if you harass other streamers off of Twitch,
yes.
that is considered mm-hmm. in violation of Twitch's terms of service. That is still relatively new. That came fully into effect this year. In January.
So I will say this, if anybody from Twitch is listening, I'm very interested to see how the 2021 numbers start shaping up because of those changes in the TOS. But I would also like to see some attention to detail on off-platform action.
I agree.
Because yeah. I think I'm a huge, huge fan of this new inclusion in the TOS.
Mm-hmm.
Because it not only says, hey, you have to behave on our platform, but if you want to exist on our platform, you've got to be a good actor, period, everywhere.
Yeah.
Or else we will find out and we will take action. We will cut you off from your revenue stream.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So we're interested to see where this is going to go. I hope that they give us a little bit more granularity
mm-hmm.
without getting too deep into the weeds, but we will see how things end up shaping up throughout 2021.
Yeah. It's time for quick hits.
I love doing my jazz hands every single time. I wish
someday people will see your jazz hands.
Someday soon, maybe. We have we got me a brand new fancy camera. We might be able to like use that.
Yeah.
And like,
I'm gonna get one of these sweet Razer Kiyo Pro cameras. Like we got the one because we wanted to test it out, and I had an expiring birthday coupon from Best Buy.
It's a really nice
Best Buy sponsor us.
They bloody well could, considering how much we talk about them.
Seriously.
All right. First up on our quick hits docket is about Microsoft's acquisition of Bethesda. The SEC has greenlit it. Now the only thing we need to do is wait for the European Union to confirm.
Yep. We have a thumbs up in the U.S. If the EU does say no, though, then that's going to be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, recall that they are waiting for comments from interested parties. They opened that up. So they said it could fall under their rules. It could be all right, but they want to hear from others who may be
just invested. In case. Absolutely. Another legal thing.
Yeah, Epic and Apple are headed to court in person. Like, obviously we knew that this case was going to see a bench trial. We've known that.
Yeah.
But the judge in the case says all the people involved, the companies, they have the resources to fly out to California and quarantine for 2 weeks before appearing in the courtroom. They think it is. And part of the reason why they said this was it is less likely that a witness will fudge the truth if they're actually sitting in a courtroom.
I think that's a brilliant idea.
Yep. The trial will begin on May 3rd. Last week we reported that it was going to be July. That was based on some erroneous information. We thought it had been delayed. So that's an error. We're correcting that now.
Correction.
So apologies here. So May 3rd in Northern California. So that's interesting. We also, and this popped up right before we started recording, we have a little more insight into Apple's strategy. Recall that they requested or subpoenaed Valve for a number, it was 420-something games, I believe. They wanted data on, and Valve's like, that's going to take us forever. Like, we don't keep all this data.
Yeah, going all the way back to how
2017.
Long? 2017.
Apple wanted it all the way back to 2015.
Yeah, that's
the judge
a lot.
Said, nah. That's,
yeah, nah, that's a lot. Not.
So
we have a little more insight,
we do.
Though.
So Rami Ismail tweeted, I saw this, that he had received a stack of legal papers, and Rami said, quote, thankfully, it's just my old little game studio sitting passively in the crossfire of two mega corporations. Now, I replied to Rami, and I said, is this because you have a game that is on both Steam and on iOS? And he said, it seems so. So Super Crate Box was Vlambeer's game that's on both of those platforms. I went to Vlambeer's site right now. It's just a text document that says, hey, we were a studio. Here were our games.
Here are some of the games we used to make.
Yep.
So now we're trying to determine if the few hundred games Apple is targeting for data on Steam are those that appear on both stores. I would imagine so.
So this is an interesting aspect to the strategy. Now we know that, or we have reasonably surmised that the reason that Apple is asking for this data is because they want to show, hey, we're not a monopoly because we exist in this bigger pool.
Mm-hmm.
So what they're doing is they're saying all these games that exist on both storefronts, well, we can't possibly have a monopoly because these few hundred games are on both, and therefore Valve gets a bunch of the sales.
I really want to go take a look at how many video games, specifically video games, not apps, video games. And I wonder if App Annie has this information of sectioning off of funneling off the games versus the apps. I'd love to see how many are on the App Store, because I would imagine that we're looking at, I don't even want to surmise. There are just, like, the App Store has been around for such a long time.
Yeah. So what Apple is trying to do is they're trying to narrow the market to only be relevant for games that exist in both places. And I think that is a sneaky redefine of the video game market that isn't accurate.
I agree.
Because what the real issue here is, and what Epic is saying is, if we just want to be on mobile and we just want to be on iOS or iOS and Android, we need a way to sell our game that doesn't, you know, cave to Apple's draconian, draconian monetization and restrictions and all of that stuff.
Yeah, Tim doesn't like walled gardens. We all know this.
Yes. So we're still watching that. We're barreling towards May, though.
We are, and we'll definitely be, we'll be on the front lines when Judge Gonzalez starts listening.
I have a funny feeling it's going to be a week of me trying to get into Zoom meetings.
Yeah, I would imagine so. I remember how hard it was for you last time.
Yes.
All right, so this is interesting. This is interesting. So the PlayStation Store is discontinuing television show and movie purchases and rentals as of August 31st. I'm going to go with it. 31st.
Yeah.
It's been a long day so far. But the nice thing is that anything that you've already purchased will still be accessible. They're not going to be taking your licenses away.
Yes. So streaming, I can't imagine this is a huge segment on either.
I doubt it.
Xbox or PlayStation?
I doubt it. I would imagine that they get more of a cut from
streaming services?
From streaming services by allowing streaming services on their platforms. You know who got rid of the streaming service on their platform?
Nintendo.
Nintendo got rid of Netflix.
Yeah, you can still do Hulu, though.
You can, yes, and Funimation, but you can't do Netflix yeah. anymore. It's very interesting. Yeah. I found that out when I went on a staycation and I stayed overnight at a hotel and I was like, I'm going to watch Netflix on my Switch. And I'm like, nope, that's not happening.
Nope. What's interesting, I wonder how much of Sony's TV and movie rental and purchases was related to Funimation, though. Because now that they own it, they
that's
might
very
not
interesting.
Need to sell. Like, I'm curious. I'm wondering how
that's
much of
very,
it was anime.
That's very, very interesting. I wonder, too. I don't know. Personally, when I think about purchasing movies and television shows, I think of Vudu and I think of Apple
Amazon.
And Amazon. Yep. That's right.
I will tell you the only way I will purchase a movie or a television program from Sony is on UMD.
I love you so much for your PlayStation Portable joke. That was wonderful. I talked about my PlayStation
Portable today.
My favorite
part of UMDs is cracking them out of those plastic shells and trying to put them into...
That was so stressful because every time I thought I was going to bloody well break it.
Yeah.
And I was like, I was what, like 18 years old?
Those things are so, and the cases like held them in tight, so.
I mean, like they hugged them, but hugged yeah, them. I was 18
they gave
years
them a
old.
Great big hug.
I was 18 years old when I purchased that. It was my first handheld console because I couldn't afford handheld consoles when I was a kid. So I was like, look at my PlayStation Portable. I'm terrified I'm going to break it.
Yeah.
It's so fragile.
Oh, UMDs.
Oh, UMDs. Okay, next step that we want to talk about is we want to talk about My.Games, which is raking in big money for Russia's Mail.ru.
So the War Robots and Warface and Skyforge maker grew its revenue 30% in 2020, reaching 40.8 billion rubles. That's 552.7 million US. It accounted this accounted for 38% of Mail.ru's revenue with an audience of 770 million players. We're keeping our eye on My.Games due to its My.Games Venture Capital Fund, which invested in 12 studios in 2020, bringing the total number of investments from the fund to 35 studios. Investments include a variety of mobile studios, including Pizza Games from the U.S. and studios in Belarus.
Veterans from Blizzard, Bungie, Riot, and Valve have secured $37.5 million in funding to start a new studio called Theorycraft Games. NetEase led the round with NEA, Bitcraft Ventures, Griffin Gaming Partners, and SISU Game Ventures all participating as well. The studio will work out of both Seattle and Los Angeles, with former Riot Executive Vice President Joe Chung leading up the team. Michael Evans, formerly of Valorant, Overwatch, and Halo, will be CTO. Former Bungie creative director Mike Tipple is the team's chief creative officer.
Hardsuit Labs, we reported on them last week as part of our Paradox earnings coverage. We mentioned that Bloodlines 2 had been delayed indefinitely, that a new studio was going to be taking over as Hardsuit had been removed from the project. Now, the other shoe dropping, this is not unexpected,
but it is still extremely sad.
Absolutely. A number of members of that team have been laid off. Lots of people on Twitter from the studio talking about it. Multiple former employees sharing that first the entire narrative team had been laid off, but not just that. Members of the studio from other departments were also laid off. Really? Our thoughts go out to them. And we're hopeful that when we finally do see Bloodlines 2, that some of their hard work will come through and that they'll have that piece of that. They'll be able to see their work in the game. And
absolutely. I have nothing but respect for the great people at Hardsuit Labs. I have had nothing but lovely interactions with that team while they were demoing Bloodlines 2. So thankfully, I know a lot of them are based in Seattle, and it's not like Seattle is a slouch about the tech and gaming industry. So hopefully each of you, if it turns out that you are listening to this show, land on your feet and don't spend too much time sitting on unemployment. Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of things that also have had the plug pulled on them, awkward. Valve has pulled the plug on Artifact, the Dota card game designed by Richard Garfield. There will be no further updates, and everything related to the game is now free for both versions. So Artifact Classic and Artifact Foundry.
Yep. What a weird story.
It was such a weird launch. Like, it's not that the game was bad. It was just that the entire business model was bad. The business model was broken. What does that remind me of?
I don't know. Amazon, Google, Stadia. I don't know.
I feel like we have a Stadia story coming up.
Do we?
We sure do.
Oh, we do. So, hey, remember when the developer of Terraria got very angry on Twitter because he had been locked out of his Google account for weeks and couldn't get any help, and then canceled the Stadia version of Terraria?
I don't remember us being baffled by this whole situation at all. Yeah, that's totally new to me.
Well, Relogic says that Google finally reached out to fix things months later. In their statement, which was buried in a development blog post, they said, quote, "Due to the hard work the Stadia team has put in, as well as our partners at 505 Games, we've decided that we will allow the upcoming launch of Terraria on Google Stadia to proceed."
Oh my goodness. Allow. I love it. I love it. I love it. That's great. We will allow. That language
I wonder how much control they actually really have. Because if they have a publisher,
then they have very little control.
And it's 505 Games, and we know the shenanigans they've pulled.
Yeah. Yeah, there's big shenanigans there.
Yeah. I'll wait for Terraria Ultimate Edition.
As it launches. Oh, no, I'm not. No, we're not going into it. I'm just going to get angry again. We're not doing it because I want to talk about happy news now.
Okay.
So remember how we talked about Valheim last week?
I do. I still haven't played it.
No, I don't think it's a game for me.
No, Loop Hero is the game for you.
Listen, I've already invested.
Loop Hero is the game for me, too, to be clear.
I'm not going to lie to you. I've played the game like it's almost 9 hours
now. Oh my goodness, Amanda. You just started it yesterday.
Oh no.
Were you playing in your sleep?
I must have been.
I use my wireless mouse and I play Loop Hero in my sleep. Loop Hero in my sleep.
That's the news I really want to report on. But in lieu of Loop Hero, Valheim has hit 5 million units sold. Last week, it was 4 million.
And the week before,
it was 3 million. Can it be stopped? Who knows?
We'll find out. But I don't think it's stopping anytime soon.
I don't think so either. Everybody's aboard the Valheim train because it is the hotness on Twitch right now. Holy crap.
Yeah. And those were quick hits.
And now it's a break. Virtual Economy is an F-Squared initiative, and along with pro bono business consulting for up-and-coming developers, it's a way we are working to give back to the community that has already given us so much. To find out more about F-Squared and the services we can provide, including pitch prep, media training, mock reviews, and business strategy guidance, visit our website at fsquared.biz.
And we are back. We have some interesting stories at the bottom half of the show here.
We really do. The first one that we want to talk about, though, is about E3 2021, which, you know, is...
Okay. In December, we said, E3, by the way, is going to be a digital event. And then, 2 weeks ago, VGC had their report that's like, yeah, E3 is very probably going to be a digital event, and et cetera, et cetera.
All right. So here's...
But wait, there's more.
So, yeah. I don't like our and-thens. Our and-thens are almost never good. So there is evidence now that E3 2021 is not going to be a live event, and it is according to minutes from a special board meeting for the Los Angeles Department of Convention and Tourism Development.
Yep.
We did see VGC report on this.
Yeah, like, so we saw them report, like, oh, there's some documentation. So we tracked down the source of the documentation.
Yeah.
VGC mentioned that it was a new report that came out of that body. It was meeting minutes from a special meeting of their board. So on slide 18 of the presentation, we've linked it in the show notes, is a list of citywide conventions on the books for 2021. E3 2021 would have meant 27,609 occupied hotel rooms for the event.
Ooh, that is big tourism money that goes bye-bye.
Indeed. E3 is a big moneymaker for the city of Los Angeles.
It really is, especially for downtown. And remember, for anyone that doesn't know Los Angeles downtown is kind of a wasteland.
Except for LA Live.
LA Live is the good stuff. There are some good restaurants, but for the most part, like, all the good restaurants are outside of downtown. All the good culture in Los Angeles is outside of downtown.
Yep.
So where the calendar would normally have a listing for E3, it now says canceled live event in 2021, working with production team on broadcast options at LA Live and LACC.
That way they retain some of the money because they're using some of the space.
Yeah. And I mean, like, that's all fine and dandy. I mean, obviously it was already booked, and like, what are they going to do?
Right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing they can really
do. Well, and LA is still a COVID hotspot.
All of LA County, not even just Los Angeles proper, but all of the county, which is enormous.
Additionally, and I this was interesting, it's noted on that same slide that the E3 license for E3 2022 and 2023 are not yet locked down. They're still being negotiated.
That's really interesting. The big speculation right now is, how do we go in a post-COVID world where we're all vaccinated, we get our regular booster shots, because I'm going to make an assumption that this is going to be like the flu.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to need to have our boosters every year. Once we have our boosters, we are inoculated. What does the world look like?
I don't know. What do
events look like? Are we even going to be comfortable to have events?
I imagine eventually we will. It will look very differently. There will probably be lots of people wearing masks, if not everyone. But for now, I don't think the ESA has the core competencies to pull off a digital event. We know that Reed Pop doesn't. We know that the ESA just gave up the ghost last year. They need to engage somebody who actually knows how to run a digital event.
And there are a number of partners out there that they could be tapping for digital events. There's a lot of people out there that know what they're doing.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm interested to see what E3 2021 is going to look like as a digital event, but I do not have high hopes for it.
Okay.
Another kind of sad piece of news. EA has delayed the next Need for Speed.
Yes. In the meantime, Criterion will be pitching in on the next Battlefield game, which we know is due out this holiday. EA Chief Studios Officer Laura Miele, on the decision in the blog post, quote, "One of the key learnings over the past year is it does take more time to make games from home, and we have to balance that need with team health.
Mm-hmm.
The best way to set our teams up for success in this environment is to be focused and ensure our biggest projects have the resources they need to deliver for our players. We're making a bold move for our teams to fully capture the opportunity in front of us with Battlefield, while maintaining the same focus on health and well-being that we've had from day one. Now, I want to talk about this for a second, because it does reveal a bit about EA. First, kudos to them for prioritizing employee health.
This is not surprising, considering the reports that we receive annually about what it is that they are doing to best steward the culture in their studio.
The second thing it says to me is that they cannot afford to delay Battlefield out of this year.
No. And honestly, when we talked about, when we started this show, and we are coming up on like when we actually started this show, I think we're almost at our anniversary.
When we come back.
It'll be our anniversary. Yes. Our 1 year. But if we look backward to look forward, we were saying that this was going to have, we were eventually going to hit the long tail.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not to say that this is going to be a bad year for gaming, because it's probably not going to be a bad year for gaming, but it is going to be continue to be a bad year for releases and for development delays.
Yeah. It's going to probably be a thinner year. We're not going to see the volume that
we would
have seen.
The glut of gorgeous games. Yes. Like, genuinely, we were spoiled last year with how many amazing games came out. So this is going to be the year of the backlog.
Indeed.
More than likely. Indeed. And I'm glad to hear that Mili is taking it so seriously that she needs to ensure the ongoing health of all of the teams at EA, and not just focusing on, oh my goodness, how are we going to get Battlefield out the door? No, we'll move resources around. She's doing what she has to do, mm-hmm. and clearly everyone is stepping up.
But, and this is the last thing it reveals, it does shine a light directly on EA's priorities. There seems to be a tiered system, or a tiered priority system at EA, where you've got Madden and FIFA and Battlefield at the top of that list. And if things need to move around so that those games get the support that they need to get, that's what's going
to
happen.
It all comes down to money. What is going to make the money? Need for Speed is not going to make them a ton of money.
Nope,
it won't. It's a niche arcade racer. It's still fun as hell. It's still an amazing IP to playground mm-hmm. in. Like, honestly, I really enjoy Need for Speed games. I love arcade racers. Like, anyone that knows me knows that my favorite kinds of games are RPGs, strategy games, and arcade racers. Mm-hmm. Like, those are my favorite kind of games.
Yep.
So the other thing that Mili pointed out is that Codemasters, which they scooped up from Take-Two, which was just...
They snaked it right out from under Take-Two.
Oh, God, it was beautiful. Like, listen, in this household, we do not stand corporations. We do not stand companies. But that was a brilliant tactical move that I deeply appreciate, mostly because I really don't like Take-Two. So Mili has said that Codemasters has several launches coming out next year. So it should fill in the gap at least a little bit for those arcade racers and for The Sims.
Yeah.
Not for Maxis's The Sims, but
Sim Racers.
But Sim Racers.
So F1, etc.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have another piece of EA news, though.
This is really interesting.
So the company scored a win in court as plaintiffs dismissed a case surrounding dynamic difficulty adjustment technology, which is a patent that EA does hold.
Yep, we talked about this back on episode 57, which was November 14th of 2020. So essentially the plaintiffs alleged that EA was scaling difficulty up in online Ultimate Team games to induce players to purchase more Ultimate Team packs.
Uh-oh.
Turns out these players were just not good at the game.
Which is okay.
Which is okay.
It's
but
okay
don't,
to not
don't,
be good at games.
Like, EA had a patent. You felt like you were getting screwed by a difficulty algorithm, and you filed a lawsuit. Like, that whole thing, you got a lawyer. The lawyers got paid.
Yeah, the lawyers got paid.
The lawyers were hoping that would be a huge class action suit and they would get paid. Now, here's the reason why it was dismissed. EA was able to evidence that dynamic difficulty adjustment isn't present in those games and never has been.
They offered up detailed technical information and access to EA's engineers as well. So while EA does own a patent for DDA technology, that technology has never been in FIFA, Madden, or NHL, and never will be.
Yep, this is a quote from EA's post about the end of the suit.
Absolutely.
So they said, we would not use DDA technology to give players an advantage or disadvantage in online multiplayer modes. In any of our games, we absolutely do not have it in FIFA, Madden, or NHL. EA and the FIFA, Madden, and NHL teams remain committed to fair play.
So if I had to, and this is a reminder, the dynamic difficulty adjustment stuff is for great accessibility in single player and story focused mm-hmm. games. This is an important piece to remember that dynamic difficulty adjustment is not a bad thing.
Yes.
It's good. It helps ensure that people that get stuck in games are able to continue to play them and not feel like they have to put it down and they're not, it, like, that game's not for them, mm-hmm. or gaming in general isn't for them. This is good technology. This technology has no place in multiplayer games.
Nope, sure doesn't. Especially because this isn't the only patent that's out there that's worried players. There was the Call of Duty, the Activision patent, which was, hey, we're going to match you with players who don't have the things that you have. When you get killed with them, we're going to shine a light on the fact that you could go buy those things yourself.
Ew, that whole thing was just so gross. Right.
But again, there's no evidence that patent was ever implemented.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I mean, like, listen, the patents exist, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're implemented. It just means that you want the rights to that technology.
Absolutely.
Okay, speaking of really cool tech stuff, though.
Yes.
Mike, what has happened?
Bloomberg, which has, this is out of their Japanese bureau, I believe, has reported again. This is not the first report we've seen out of them. In fact, they had some early reports on the PS5 as well. They've reported again on the rumored Switch Pro, or our preferred name, the Super Nintendo Switch.
The Super Nintendo Switch!
Yep. If the report's correct, the new Switch will feature a larger 7-inch 720p OLED screen. The current screen is a 6.2-inch LCD on the Switch.
So, and it's a 5.5-inch LCD on the Switch Lite. So, like, that's all fine and dandy. Cool thing about this, though, is that the shift to the OLED will reduce battery consumption, increase contrast, and potentially offer faster response times. Now, there are people that are saying, like, why is it 720p?
I think this is a good question. Jeff Grubb actually addressed this head on, like, so right after this report good. Came out. So when you're talking about a screen of that size, you have to talk about pixel density as well as resolution.
Which is why when we look at our phones, mm-hmm. because our phones, it is all about pixel density. I have designed for phones like this. Mm-hmm. Pixel density is everything.
Absolutely. So at 720p, mm-hmm. at 16 inches away from your face, which is about the distance that most people play, it looks like a retina screen. It looks like the retina screen on my iPad that I'm looking at right now.
That makes good sense. Absolutely. You don't need it to be more than that.
Yep.
You just need it to present the highest definition that you can based on that pixel density. Mm-hmm.
So, according to the Bloomberg report, these screens will be manufactured by Samsung starting this summer. And we're looking at...
Great manufacturer, too.
Yeah.
Like, our televisions are...
We have Samsung TVs and we're happy with them.
Yeah, we love our Samsung TVs.
Allegedly, reportedly, that the new Switch will be capable of up to 4K when docked.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Oh, we have a listener question.
We do.
We never get listener questions. I love listener questions. I get very excited about them. So this is a question from Dan Sandler. Mm-hmm. So his question for us is, what are your thoughts that this could be marketed as the, quote, Switch XL and be pushed out there the exact same way as the 3DS? Not a new console generation for the Switch, but an extension of the current lines.
Yeah, I think he means the new 3DS. And here's the thing. We're on the same page here. We actually... expect that that's going to be the case.
Absolutely.
They're not looking to make a generational shift here. They mm-hmm. want all these games to carry over. There will probably be a small number of games that will require the new hardware, just like there was a small number of games that required the new 3DS when it came out.
Because it was the dual analog.
Beyond that, it was just actual memory. So Xenoblade Chronicles, when it came out on 3DS, you couldn't play it on the original 3DS or 3DS XL, you had to play it on the new 3DS.
Yes. The only reason why I got a new 3DS at all, which is sitting, I think, in mm-hmm. my bin, is because I wanted to play some of the games that I just couldn't play on my 3DS XL.
Right. So if you mentioned the dual analog sticks. Before the new 3DS, you had to get the Circle Pad Pro.
Really? I never knew that we actually went out and purchased a Circle Pad Pro for me while we were in Los Angeles that one time. And where the hell did we go? We went to some kind of GameStop outside of downtown LA to go find a Circle Pad Pro for like $15. It was nuts.
Yeah, we were playing the Final Fantasy Monster Hunter alike.
It was fun, but oh my goodness, we spent so much time trying to get my 3DS to actually like do the thing because yours did natively, and I'm like, I don't have the money to spend on this. This was, you know, before I moved here, so mm-hmm. very, very fun.
Yep. So if Bloomberg's correct.
Yes. So if Bloomberg is correct, and they're normally fairly accurate, they say that Nintendo plans to release the new model this holiday to compete against the Xbox Series X and the PlayStation 5. I don't by the whole competition thing, Nintendo is its own thing and doesn't really one-to-one compete with anyone because it's different.
So here's my feeling on this. I think this is, whether we call it competition or we talk about it as staying relevant in a market of high-end gaming, for me, this is keeping software relevant as opposed to the hardware, and third-party software. So if somebody is planning on release, if a publisher or developer is planning on releasing a game on Xbox Series X and PlayStation 5 and Switch, my feeling is that it's going to very quickly, and we're already starting to see this, that the power gap is starting to widen, and the Switch version is just not...
It's not good enough.
Yeah, the sacrifices that people were willing to make for the Switch version, the portability, right? Mm-hmm. They're no longer going to be willing to make because they'd be giving up too much. So you have this new Switch version that, again, isn't likely to be as powerful as the Xbox Series X or the PlayStation 5, but will continue that power, that will narrow that power gap again so that the benefits you get from playing on a Switch, being able to take it with you, being able to lay on the couch and play it, not with the screen.
Honestly, it's the laying on the couch that got me, because I don't know about any of you, but I don't leave my house, so except to go to Target.
So Dan, I think we're on the same page that this is about...
This is
an extension of the generation, so that Nintendo has more time to figure out whatever's next. There's no reason to move on from the Switch. It's exceptionally powerful right now.
In terms of its marketability, and we look at its market penetration in general, it is an essential in any household that plays games. Yep. It really is. And there are multiple Switches per household that have them. Mm-hmm. And as we talked about during Nintendo's earnings, that is what they are looking toward. They are looking toward multiple Switches in households. They are looking to further saturate the market. It's only a good thing. This is only a good thing for us as players, and for Nintendo as the manufacturer and platform holder, to create an extension of this line that will bring in potentially new players that are like, you know, I was thinking about getting a Switch, but it wasn't powerful enough, and I want to be able to keep up with my buddies, but I also want to... Anyway, the point being is that this is only a good thing.
Yep, and this is the time... I still believe this is the time to do it. This is going to be the first holiday. Holiday 2021 is going to be the first holiday where we assume that supply for the Xbox Series and the PlayStation 5 are going to be very, very easy to come by, or relatively easy to come by, as opposed to launch year, which we knew it's still a nightmare.
Yeah. It definitely, definitely still is. Yeah. And it's not surprising that it is a nightmare.
So exciting. I will be there on day one, provided I can get a pre-order. I will have a Switch Pro. I will do that. Or a Nintendo, or Super Nintendo
Switch. Super Nintendo Switch. Yep. Do it.
All right. Last story of the day. And this is the biggie.
So this is the question that we are positing. What happens when a publisher and developer go to war? Back in August, on episode 42, we reported on the legal fight between Nacon, formerly Big Ben Interactive, and Frogwares over The Sinking City. Mm-hmm. The TLDR on this one is Frogwares alleged a breach of contract and had the game pulled down everywhere, PC and console.
Then in early January, on episode 64, we reported that Nacon had scored a win in court, forcing the game to be relisted, essentially with the judge in French court saying that Frogware's action was not in compliance with the law because the contract
dispute
it was unlawful. It was, the contract dispute was still ongoing. Essentially, the judge saying in that case, hey, maybe wait until the matter is settled before you take this action.
Yeah.
They weren't granted injunctive relief, but they essentially took injunctive action. Mm-hmm. So the judge was like, I don't think so.
So now there's an all-out war. Frogwares has once again DMCA'd the Sinking City, forcing a removal from Steam. However, the game remains live on consoles, and there's a reason why things are unfolding like this.
So when the game was relisted on console storefronts, Frogwares was the publisher of record for PlayStation and Nintendo eShop, as well as EA Origin and Games Planet. Nacon is still the publisher for other platforms, so that includes Xbox and Steam. So it's a mess. You have multiple different parties putting out what should be the same game on different distribution platforms.
However, because we know that Frogwares is not the publisher of record on Steam, Nacon controls the Steam version.
Yep, and I actually spoke with somebody from Frogwares this week, and we got comments directly from Nacon during this, so there is a lot of bad blood here is the first thing I will tell you. And a lot of, I would say that Frogwares is a little bit more vocal about coming, or they're a little bit easier about coming across about with their frustration. Nacon's statements seem frustrated as well, but they're trying to handle things in what would traditionally be the appropriate venue, as it were.
Indeed.
So the way this all started to unfold, Frogwares tweeted out that people should not purchase the version of The Sinking City that's currently on Steam. Now, at the time, their Twitter account was still integrated with the Steam store page.
Yep.
And of course, when that happens, there's an update that pops up in the newsfeed. So the store page for The Sinking City said, hey, don't buy this game.
Oh boy. All right. So Nacon ended up following all of these shenanigans up with a response via Steam. So here's their comment. Quote, we regret that Frogwares persists in disrupting the release of The Sinking City. It was Frogwares who came to Nacon to request financing for the development of the game, and to date, more than 10 million euros have been paid to Frogwares by Nacon. It was Frogwares that relied on our marketing and promotion teams, representing thousands of hours of work and several million euros worth of investment. Now that the game has been fully developed and published, largely thanks to Nacon's money and work, Frogwares would like to revise the terms of the contract to their sole advantage. It's easy to play the victim, oh boy. But all we seek is that Frogwares respect its commitments both in the contract and as demanded by the courts.
Now remember that this all started with Frogwares alleging that Nacon had withheld more than €1 million of unpaid royalties.
Which is a lot of money.
I take issue with one thing in this statement, that when they say that it was
Their work.
Thanks to Nacon's money and work. I believe that Nacon's money was involved, but Nacon did not make the game. I believe that they contributed, that their work was valuable to the sales of the game.
When developer publisher relationships work as they are intended to, it is extremely symbiotic.
Yes.
As we know from the developers that have worked specifically with Raw Fury, with Devolver Digital.
Absolutely.
And such.
So Nacon also pinned broken features like cloud saves and achievements on Frogwares intransigence. So Frogwares tells us a different story.
Yeah.
And not just us, they put out a video. So the tale they tell is one of Nacon hacking a version of the game it purchased on GamesPlanet, which, as I previously mentioned, is controlled by Frogwares. That's one where they have distribution control.
Because Frogwares didn't comply with a request to provide a Steam-ready copy.
Yeah. Essentially, what Frogwares is alleging in this YouTube video, and we linked it in the show notes, Nacon allegedly purchased a copy of the game just like any consumer. You go to GamesPlanet right now and purchase the game, you would be doing, according to Frogwares, exactly what Nacon did. Now, what happened after that, according to Frogwares in this video, is that Nacon decompiled the game. They hacked it. And they have evidence of a digital footprint in there of how it was hacked. So they changed the splash screen, not by recompiling it with a new name, but by creating a new splash screen and renaming it to what the original file was, which is labeled as GamesPlanet, and just replacing that file.
Oh.
So the reason why that's the case is because they didn't have the code, the key that's necessary to access the files, so they had to hack it.
Okay, so this is where things get, things are sticky enough already, but things get really gnarly at this point. So we approached Nacon for a comment, and they ended up sending us back to the Steam page with the post that had been put out long before the hack. The company did follow up after the DMCA in the video, though, and this is what they had to say. Quote, in line with the court's decision, Nacon has repeatedly and unsuccessfully requested that Frogwares make the game available on Steam, failing which it would apply a clause in the contract wherein such a case, the game would be adapted by a third party. Frogwares then attempted, without the knowledge of Nacon and in violation of our rights, to make the game available on Steam without mentioning Nacon in its capacity as the publisher. This is, therefore, clear proof that no technical impossibility prevents the game from being put back on Steam. So, it isn't about technical impossibility.
Yeah, we're beyond technical impossibilities. The thing here is that what Nacon is saying is that they had the right to have a third party work on the project. Now, I have signed contracts that have similar clauses where it's like, hey, if you're not available, you know, we need the source code so that we can update the game.
Yeah, we've seen, this is stuff that would, in theory, be in this contract. Absolutely.
Sure. But what Nacon is saying is because Frogwares didn't turn over a copy of the game or the source code, remember, they declined to turn over the source code back when we first covered this, that they were well within their rights to decompile and hack the game.
Oh, boy.
Yes.
So...
apparently, also, this is another piece of it. Frogwares released a version of the game that had more content on Games Planet.
Oh, really?
And apparently, because that was what was hacked and put back up on Steam, according to Frogwares, Nacon has published content that they don't have the rights to. Again, according to Frogwares. Without having seen these contracts.
We don't know what's going on here. All we can do is just kind of report on what we're seeing. And it's a lot. It's a lot. So... Nacon is reiterating its investment of 10 million euro. However, what started this is Frogwares' allegation that Nacon had not fulfilled all of its financial obligations, just like Mike had said, about the withholding $1 million in euro of royalties. Here's something that caught
Real quickly on that, though.
Okay.
So in the second statement, they do say that they've followed up, they have fulfilled all of their financial commitments. So now we are at a fundamental disagreement here, if I'm reading between the lines, where Frogwares thinks, no, we're entitled to these royalties, and Nacon says, no, we've paid you everything you're owed. So it could be that there is a dispute over a section of the money that Frogwares thinks it's entitled to,
but might not be.
Like, this is where the courts are going to need to parse through all of this.
It's very true, because again, we don't have access to these contracts. Yeah. So Mike, there was something that you mentioned in our show notes. What's going on with this statement?
Yeah. So in the past, Frogwares has, this is again from the Nacon statement. In the past, Frogwares has improperly relied on accusations regarding a lack of payment to refuse delivery of the game on Steam, at which point they tried to unsuccessfully terminate the contract. The Paris Court of Appeal deemed this action, quote, manifestly unlawful, ordering the continuation of the contract and encouraging Frogwares to refrain from, quote, from any action which would impede such continuation. The contract termination wasn't the, quote, manifestly unlawful part. It was how Frogwares went about it, though, based on
which was the delisting.
Right. So Nacon here, I think, not being entirely correct in how they're framing it, because they're trying to say Frogwares tried to cancel this contract and they had no right to try to cancel the contract. No, you can have a right to try if you're going through the right avenues. It's that the way they went about it is what the courts, based on the reports that I went back and read, that the court said was manifestly unlawful. This case is absolutely wild, and I don't know if Frogwares has made the right call fighting it in the court of public, in the town square, as it were.
Yeah, the public opinion of the rest of the world. And Twitter is a poor forum for anything even remotely nuanced. And there is clearly nuance to this case that we don't fully understand. And as Mike and I are North Americans, we are not in Europe, and certainly we are not in France. I am not familiar with French law myself. So I'm only really familiar with Canadian law and then kind of a little bit American law, which is way more complex.
However, if you are familiar with French law and you would like to talk to us, we would love to talk with you. So hit us up.
You want to hit us up at podcast@fsquared.biz for that, because we want to listen to everything that you have to say about French law. That would be a fascinating conversation.
But this case has a lot of twists and turns, and where we are right
plot
now.
Twist.
Yeah. Where we are right now is ugly, and I don't see it getting any less ugly before the end of the day.
No, I would imagine this is going to get even uglier. But you know what's not ugly, Mike? This show. This show has been beautiful.
Oh, it's our beautiful baby.
It's our beautiful baby show.
It's our baby.
Thanks, Moira. So that's it. That has been this episode of Virtual Economy. Thank you for listening to our podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Virtual Econcast. I am at Amanda Farrow.
And I am at Footerish. I am told that this is me on this page. This one's me. Yeah. Futterish.
He has to, like, every time we do a sign off now.
Do.
So you can subscribe to our RSS feed at our website, virtualeconcast.com. We are also available on all major podcasting platforms, including Spotify, iHeartRadio, Apple Podcast, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Cast. There's one more.
Pocket Sand.
Oh, man, I got Pocket Sanded again. If you enjoyed this episode and it is your first time listening to Virtual Economy, thank you so much for joining us. And if you enjoyed this episode, we'd love it if you could subscribe and, if possible, review the show.
Yeah, we do love to know what you think. And if you have questions, please shoot them to us via DM at Virtual Econcast on Twitter. You can send us an email, podcast@fsquared.biz. And if you have super secret information that you want to share with us, we both have Signal and we would be delighted to share our Signal numbers with you. You can just ping us by email or on our Twitter, Virtual Econcast, and we'll share our signal numbers with you.
Absolutely. So this is normally when we'd say we'll be back next week. We are not doing a news show next week. We may have an interview show.
Maybe.
We don't know yet. It hasn't
been scheduled yet. But if we do, there may be something for you.
There may be something for you. We may be having an interview. If not, we're taking the week off next week.
We've hit the pandemic wall.
We hit the pandemic wall 2 months ago.
Yes. So we are taking a little break. We've gotten an Airbnb and we are going to be just chill.
Yeah, we're not doing anything.
We're taking the entire week off, but we're going away for a few days at the end of the week.
Yes. And we are still staying safe, which is something that is really, really, really important, even as we move through vaccinations throughout the United States and throughout the rest of the world. So here's what we want for you in lieu of an episode next week, potentially. Wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another.
We'll see you in 2 weeks.